This episode is brought to you by Apeel, helping you enjoy your fruits and vegetables at peak freshness and reduce food waste. Learn more at Apeel.com. Good evening and welcome to Eating Matters, where we talk about food systems and policy and how they impact all of us. I'm your host, Jenna Liute, and we're broadcasting on Heritage Radio Network. In 2016, farmers overwhelmingly voted for Trump over Hillary Clinton. But life in rural America, and especially on the farm, has arguably not improved under a Trump administration. For example, shortly after the election, Trump started a trade war with China that significantly decreased farm incomes, especially for small and medium-sized farms. There has been a spate of climate change-induced extreme weather events that has devastated farm states, while the administration has doubled down on rolling back over 100 different environmental regulations and ramped up fossil fuel development. Dairy farmers continue to go out of business at a record rate, and the gross mishandling of COVID-19 has resulted in substantial losses for many farmers. Just to give a couple of examples. So with November 3rd firmly behind us, I wanted to take a closer look at the election results to see how, and more importantly, why, the majority of farmers cast their votes for one candidate over the other. What are those historical and present-day issues that have led farmers to be a more conservative voting bloc? And what can be done to bridge the urban-rural divide that seems to be getting more entrenched with each passing year? Joining me to answer all of these questions and more is journalist Chuck Abbott. Chuck is the editor of the Food and Environment Reporting Network's Ag Insider, and he has 3 decades of Washington experience covering U.S. food and agricultural policy at the national level. Chuck, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. I appreciate having the invitation.
All right. So the election is over. I mean, for, I don't know, like 60% of the country. And I want to take a look back and see what the margins actually netted out at in terms of Trump winning rural America and specifically farmers. He did so in 2016, and I know some of this data is still being parsed out, but how different did 2020 look?
2020 looked a lot like 2016, with the possibility that Trump improved his margins slightly. This is according to analysis done by the folks at the Daily Yonder, who've been doing this sort of analysis of the presidential elections for the last 3 or 4 cycles. So they have lots of ways to make the comparisons. It's basically 2-to-1 vote Republican versus Democrat in rural America. It's hard to get a solid number on how farmers voted because farmers are a very small part of the population, 1 or 2%. So it's hard to capture those people when you're doing like gigantic exit polls or even polling, the standard sort of public opinion polling. Most of the polling that tried to get farmers' views before the election either were straw polls where where some organization like a magazine said, if you're a farmer, tell us how you're going to vote. Mm-hmm. and those sort of, like I said, that's a straw poll. I mean, those sort of things always came in with, somewhere between 75 and 85% of respondents saying they were going to vote for Donald Trump. One of the news organizations, DTN, which also owns the Progressive Farmer chain of magazines, those are farm magazines, did a poll of rural Americans, and this was one of those scientifically valid polls of rural Americans, and it came in with a very high percentage of people who were going to vote for the Republican candidate for president. And their number was a little bit lower than some of these straw polls. It was a little bit lower than what some people might have said was Trump's margin 4 years ago. But, it was still an extraordinarily high percentage of people supporting the president.
Yeah. I mean, he improved margins. That is
right. Yeah. Yeah.
Surprising.
I mean, we're talking like improving margins by like 1 or 2 percentage points.
Yeah.
So well, still, you know, for instance,
we're going to get into why, and I still have a hard time wrapping my head around it. But
well, one of the reasons, you know, one of the reasons why is that there were fewer third-party candidates. That made that. I mean, the Daily, as I said, the Daily Yonder crunched these numbers, and they came up with this fascinating fact that, in just terms of how many votes you got, Democrats and Republicans both did better in 2020 in the rural vote because there were fewer third-party candidates running. So, and one of the interesting things is that the increase in rural vote for Biden, helped Biden preserve the victories that he was getting in the cities and in the suburbs.
Wow.
By one analysis, it was the suburbs that were decisive this time in giving the election to Biden.
Yeah.
4 years ago, the rural vote was the key because, Hillary Clinton won the cities and, Trump and Clinton, basically split the suburbs.
So historically speaking, farmers have tended to vote more conservatively. If we look at farmers as a voting bloc, what are some of the major platform and policy issues that have led them to vote this way in the past?
Well, we're going to, for a moment, we can talk about, as you said, farmers are traditionally conservative. For the moment, we'll take like this big picture view.
Yeah.
Which is, agriculture is a capital intensive and financially illiquid enterprise. You can go back through history, and that's the way, that's the way historians describe it.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, because we say capital intensive, because you have to put money into acquiring property, whether it's sweat equity or purchasing it. You need the equipment. You need some sort of almost every farming operation needs some type of motive power, whether it's tractor, whether it's gasoline powered or animal power. You need a lot of stuff to be in farming. But you only, because it trends in, if you're grain farming, you get one harvest a year in most cases. So that means you have one chance a year to make money. As a result, farmers tend to be, prudence is a virtue. And holding on to your money often is a good idea because, you don't have a chance to make it very often. And for long, long periods of time, farming was a very low income very low income undertaking. In a lot of cases, people, grew and ate a lot of what they needed, so they didn't need a lot of money. But still, you didn't have a lot of cash floating around, so it made it, it became an imperative to hold on to money. So that makes you a conservative. So when you're going to do what things attract farmers or rural people to particular parties, things like, talking about, less regulation, low taxes, finding some sort of outlet for farm products, anything that will increase farm income, those sorts of things really, really are attractive.
Mm-hmm. Right, understandably.
Right. So, for example, in 2016, Trump's, selling points in rural America basically were less regulation, tax cuts, regulatory relief. I said regulatory relief twice, didn't I? And support for corn ethanol. And those were all good. Those would all be good ideas to if you're a Republican in general. In 2016, farm groups were exercised over the waters of the United States. Regulation proposed by the Obama administration.
Mm-hmm.
In agricultural groups, in agricultural groups, they always regard the agriculture department as their friend and the EPA as an adversary.
Interesting.
So, having a candidate who talked about, rolling back regulations, and in particular, WOTUS, as this clean water rule was known, and that was attractive. So,
why did farmers hate WOTUS so much?
It was portrayed by by the farm groups and by some of their allies, such as the home builders, as an encroachment on private property.
Okay.
That's the short, answer. I mean, the Farm Bureau said it would, said it would end up with the government regulating dry ditches because water ran in them, every so often. Now, the Obama administration said that this was an exaggeration of the effect of the WOTUS proposal, mm-hmm. and that it would be no more, encompassing than regulations that had been in place back in the Reagan-Bush years.
Yeah. I think it is really fitting that you said regulatory relief twice, because that seems to be the biggest theme of this administration, deregulation.
Yeah.
So
right.
I think
yeah.
you can't say it enough,
right.
talking about, what the past 4 years have looked like, certainly for food and ag. And by the way, speaking of the Reagan administration, I have this personal theory that everything bad we're experiencing in America today can be traced directly back to policy decisions in the Reagan administration specifically. And like certainly in the 80s, rural America had a really tough time, right? We saw quarter of a million farms were lost during this decade. And
when we talk about farms being lost, I mean, one thing you have to recognize is that since the end of World War II, mm-hmm. the number of farms in the United States has dropped precipitously. And that's due to mechanization, synthetic fertilizers, and pesticides, and hybrid seeds. It led to an incredible increase in productivity per person, larger, with the result that farmers could. Individual farmers could, operate larger pieces of land by themselves. So mm-hmm. essentially, you didn't need as many people out on the farmland. I mean, the number of farms in the United States peaked at a little bit above 7 million during the Great Depression. And the 2017 Census of Agriculture says there's 2.04 million farms now. But getting back to the 1980s, because you did have a point there. Which was there was an agricultural recession in the mid 80s mm-hmm. that was truly wrenching. I mean, movies were made about it. At one point, there were three Hollywood movies circulating that sort of touched on the effects of the recession on agriculture. People who were assistant secretaries in the Department of Agriculture were known by name and reviled as the culprits for foreclosures on farm loans.
Wow.
That tells you what it was like. So, the 1980s was indeed a hard, they are the hardest times in probably living memory for almost anyone in agriculture.
And to what extent did those, what happened 3 to 4 decades ago, can that explain where we are today, if at all?
Like
the residual anger or, displacement from rural communities.
Among other things, the 1980s are the reference point for everything that's going on right now.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Because my backup, when I say everything that's going on right now, since 2013, 2014, agricultural prices and farm income have been, reduced levels, because they reached records in 2013 and 2014, and then declined in 1 year. Farm income was almost half of what it was at the peak. But every so often you'll see reports about rising rates, rising numbers of farm bankruptcies, or things like increase in debt held by farmers. And the comparison everybody always makes is this as bad as the 1980s?
And
the answer, somewhat reassuring or not, is no, it's not that bad.
Well, that's
good. There's always, one thing that happened in the recession, in the agriculture recession of the mid-80s, was that there was, you know, an immense rewriting of some of the rules governing agriculture. And one of the ways of resolving the huge debts that farmers faced was that, you know, in some cases, lenders were required to take a loss on some of the loans.
Really?
Yeah. And, one result, but not necessarily during, you know, I mean, one lingering effect, lingering pass-along effect is that USDA now tends more to provide loan guarantees than to offer loans directly itself. But some of you could also say that maybe that may reflect the Reagan era desire to reduce the role of government and let private enterprise have a greater role in these sorts of things like financing agriculture.
Okay.
So in
fast forwarding, so we talked about what he kind of ran on in 2016, and then he won the election. Trump won the election, and then he started a trade war. Like that happened pretty quick, right? With China.
Right.
How did this start, and what were the impacts that farmers felt because of it?
Well, you know, it was, you know, the trade war, of course. Well, it started somewhat slowly. I mean, there were complaints about, you know, dishwashers or clothes washers, and there was some escalation. But you know, the trade war really took effect in mid 2018, and the effect was to reduce U.S. farm exports. I did the math months ago, and I have to bring it back to mind. You know, somewhere around 7%, which is, you know, it's not happy times.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, farm exports are roughly 20% of production, which means, you know, that's 20% of farm income. So you know, 20 cents of every dollar comes from overseas sales. So I was telling you about how in 2013, 2014, those were the peak years for farm income. Exports were $152 billion.
Wow.
That's fiscal 2014. Mm-hmm. In fiscal 2019, they were $135.5 billion.
Okay.
Which is nearly $20 billion less.
Yeah.
And that $135.5 billion in fiscal 19 was, about $8 billion less than the year before. And and since then, exports have been roughly stagnant.
Okay.
They're supposed to get better next year, but that's on the basis of there'll be a recovery from the global pandemic, and that, you know, trade with China will improve. And trade with China has improved a little bit. Some USDA statistics say that sales to China of agricultural exports are around $17 billion in fiscal 2020, which, you know, ended September 30th. The year before, they were like $10
billion. Okay.
And, of course, it's not just a simple linear increase in total exports because, you know, some of the commodities that went to China were diverted from, you know, other customers. But still, you had a, you know, which is why we end up with overall exports sort of, whole, you know, treading water.
So, and that mostly affected commodity farmers, right?
Yes. I mean, soybeans were the biggest single product, biggest single agricultural product exported to China. Around, you know, I'm trying to remember now. Yeah, maybe $20 billion a year.
I mean, this really impacted farmers. Did they see it coming, or was it kind of like, did they blindside?
Well, it was a surprise because we'd had years of China growing in prominence as an import customer. At the time the trade war started, it was the largest market for U.S. agricultural exports, but it was also in many instances, the largest importer in the world for anything. I mean, it was the leading importer of soybeans and, you know, here we are, most prominently soybeans and cotton.
Yeah. So, so what yeah. were What did the administration do to offset the effects of the tariffs?
Well, they used a Depression era agency, which is part of the USDA, which was created to improve commodity farm prices and farm income. It has an incredibly broad charter. This is an agency called the Commodity Credit Corporation. It's just almost on paper. Its officers are the leading, are the top officials of the USDA.
Okay.
And as I said, it has this incredibly broad power of all the things it can do, because almost anything can fit into the description of improve farm income or bolster commodity prices. The Trump administration spent enormous amounts of money through the CCC to support farm income. First, it created a short-term program called the Market Facilitation Program, only supposed to last 1 year. They sent, if I'm remembering right, $8.6 billion in cash to farmers and ranchers. It was supposed to be a one-year program. Well, the trade war continued. The next year, they came back and created, did the Market Facilitation Program one more time. In this case, it was $14.5 billion in cash to farmers and ranchers. And then we had the pandemic. And the administration created yet another short-term program called the Coronavirus Food Assistance Program. And it's had two iterations. And between the two of them, those have sent $20 billion to farmers and ranchers.
So that's a lot of money.
Yeah, it's a lot of money. At one point, I was doing the math, and it comes out above $40 billion. And if you make a couple assumptions about everything being spent, you could get up to $50 billion. But you have to say, you have to be aware that the first iteration of the Coronavirus Food Assistance Program spent only about 2/3 of the money that was supposed to be available.
Really?
So, so they spent $10 billion when they thought they might be spending $16
billion. I mean, so much for fiscal responsibility, the party of fiscal,
is the argument that has been made. But one of the constraints that lawmakers faced, because they're working, as you said, it's easy at this stage to say the Republicans always run on fiscal restraints, balanced budgets, so on. And there was criticism on Capitol Hill, but the problem you face is that there truly was, I'm not going to say crisis, but farm income was definitely taken a hit because of the trade war, and these are, you won't believe it from the spending, but these are austere times as far as congressional budgeting goes. So there was no extra money sloshing around somewhere that Congress could get to and say, "We're going to do this." So the committees of jurisdiction, as we say, just let the administration go ahead.
Well, I mean, and listen, COVID highlighted many major weaknesses in our food and ag system and brought these into the national spotlight. And, for farmers, we saw images of whole fields being plowed under and dairy farmers who've had a horrible go of it, for a very long time now, just dumping hundreds of gallons of milk and hogs being slaughtered because they couldn't be, processed. I mean, it was a mess, right?
In the spring, there were huge disruptions because a large portion of agricultural production had gone to the restaurants and schools and others, other what they would call institutional settings.
Yeah.
And those almost disappeared overnight.
Yeah. Action needed to be taken.
Right. Yeah. And there was it was very easy to justify for the government taking steps to mitigate the impact.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, I would have to say that, you know, there was, you know, the Congress spent, you know, what was it, $3 trillion on CARES relief, so.
And more is, you could say, needed. I think the one thing that just jumped out on me, I read this in Civil Eats that in both 2019 and 2020, more than 40% of farm incomes came from federal assistance.
Oh, well, this year it will be right at 40%, I think.
It will be.
And last year it was somewhat less than that. It's been a rising share, mostly because the government was putting more money into agriculture.
Right.
But, you know, this year, because of the effects of the coronavirus in winter and early spring, there were projections that farmer income from crops and livestock would be the lowest, you know, total in a decade. So, you know, there were reasons for action. Yeah.
In terms of a model, it seems like it's pretty clear there needs to be some sort of reform in happening.
That is one of the things that's being discussed. That, you know, this is a huge, you know, there's a huge amount of money that's being poured into the sector at the moment, and as I was describing these programs, MFP is the trade war payments renown, and CFAP is the coronavirus payments renown. Those all expired. I shouldn't say they all expired, but, you know, MFP is dead. It's gone. Not, you know, they paid the last of the money in that program early this year. CFAP won the first iteration. That, you know, the sign up on that ended in September, so that the money's been essentially paid out of that. Mm-hmm. The second iteration of CFAP, sign up began in September, and, you know, some of the spending is expected to run into the new year, but that's it. And then what you have remaining is the traditional farm supports, programs, which are crop supports, you know, land stewardship programs, things like that.
Ethanol. I want to talk about ethanol. It's a super, you know, important, obviously, economic issue for commodity farmers. And it seems to have been going, because, like, there seems to have been a lot of back and forth with this administration. Mm-hmm. What actions have been taken to support this industry, and what have the effects been to date?
All right. Here we go. I mean, ethanol was one of the answers, you know, to overproduction in agriculture. Yeah, back in the 70s and 80s, and then it sort of trickled along as a local project or a state level, you know, initiative. And then, you know, in the 80s and 90s, it became, you know, at one point there was, there was federal money sent into ethanol.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there is no direct federal subsidy of ethanol, you know, hasn't been for a number of years. But what has happened is, you know, that back in there, mid-2000s, the Congress passed a law which took effect, you know, which created the Renewable Fuel Standard, which guarantees biofuels like corn ethanol and biodiesel, which is made from soybean oil and other materials, guarantees, you know, biofuels a share of the gasoline market. So that's one way that the United States has supported use of biofuels. And part of this push was, you know, it was the idea of reducing reliance on imported oil, and that, you know, biofuels would lead the way to cleaner burning fuels and reduce air pollution.
Good intentions.
The RFS set a ladder of gradually increasing amounts of biofuels that were supposed to be mixed into the gasoline supply. It's reached the top of the ladder, did that a couple of years ago, $15 billion gallons a year of ethanol and some modest amounts of biodiesel, a couple billion gallons a year, and what they call advanced biofuels, which are second generation biofuels. They're required to produce less air pollution, and which are supposed to come from things like cellulosic ethanol, which is made out of woody plants and grasses. Anyway, so it's gone up to 15 billion gallons. But in the last 2-3 years, the ethanol industry has been upset because of increasing use by oil refiners of hardship waivers. So-called, these are called small refinery exemptions, which were designed as part of RFS to give a break to small volume refiners who were unable to mix enough ethanol into their gasoline and who otherwise would have to spend, punishingly large amounts of money to buy credits to bring themselves into compliance with the RFS. I mean, these credits are called RINs, for renewable identification numbers. And they're essentially a way of saying, okay, I didn't use enough ethanol, but I got, somebody else used more than they needed, so I bought some of their RINs, so I get credit for using ethanol. But, under the Trump administration, the number of these hardship waivers has increased dramatically, like 3 times. The ethanol industry claims that the, I shouldn't say claims, the ethanol industry says the waivers have reduced ethanol usage by 4 billion gallons cumulatively over the last, 4 or 5 years. Of course, the oil industry says no such thing. So that's one point. There's been a squabbling over the waivers. The biofuel groups and and some of the farm groups want the EPA to stop issuing waivers.
Right.
At the same time, the industry also has been asking for year-round, for approval of year-round sales of E15, which is a, it's 15% blend of ethanol into gasoline. The traditional blend rate is 10%. The idea with E15, of course, is that you use, 50% more ethanol in every gallon. Great way to increase, your share of the gasoline market. Until May of last year, people were, retailers were not allowed to sell E15 during the summer. The argument was it was too volatile, likely to evaporate. And if it evaporated, it would cause ozone precursors, I think is the problem. So
sounds bad.
That's not good.
I don't want that.
So they, so it was a big deal to get the administration to agree to allow year-round sale of E15. And part of this was done through studies to prove that it wasn't, that E15 wasn't as evaporative as feared. And part of it was just, done through the argument of, we decided that E10 was all right. So why are you worried about E15? It's not much different. So there you are. So those two things have been going on. The farm groups have been trying to expand the network of filling stations that sell higher grades of biofuels. There's a government, there's a USDA program that awards grant and loan money to retailers to install the pumps and the tanks that you need for the higher grades of gasoline. All that stuff. The biggest, one of the things that's bothering the ethanol industry right now is that every year the EPA is required to announce the RFS targets for the coming year. Usually these are unveiled around, mid-year. EPA takes public comment and, around November 1st issues the RFS for the coming year. That hasn't happened yet.
Okay.
And that is, before the election, the ethanol industry and some of the farm groups were saying it was time for EPA to finish the job. You know, you've acted on E15. Now it's time to, you know, assure us of 15 billion gallons in the new year. And to do that, get rid of those waivers.
Yeah.
Andrew Wheeler, administrator at EPA, says, well, we've got one court case that might, or one lawsuit that might be heard by the Supreme Court on the issue of waivers. So I just can't make a ruling on waivers right now. And, you know, we can't really, you know, and then we have to wait on RFS because the pandemic, you know, at one point caused a huge reduction in gasoline usage. Yeah. So, you know, the government needs more time to figure out what's the likely demand for gasoline going to be in the new year so it can set an appropriate, you know, and proportional, you know, target for biofuels.
Were they just stalling, just waiting for the election?
Some people would say that.
Yeah.
There was, you know, that, this is among the reasons why before the election, the ethanol people were saying, finish the job.
Yeah. Were they like, we don't want to make anyone mad, we want all of your votes?
Yeah, we want the oil, you know. And one thing that you have to take into account is that the farm groups often turn to President Trump as the referee in this dispute. And the dispute between the oil industry and the ethanol people and trying to get EPA to make a definitive statement on some of these issues. And, you know, and Trump, you know, in a couple of the times that he intervened, trying to come up with solutions that would give both each side something.
Okay.
So, you know,
how did that pan out?
Well, it resolved the dispute for, you know, like 6 months at a time.
Okay.
And then, you know, then folks on either side would begin to believe that the folks on the other side were making trouble. And, you know, we would start arguing again about, well, it's time to set the RFS.
Yeah.
And the oil industry would say, well, the RFS doesn't work. Let's get rid of it. It should just be let the market decide.
In laying out all of these issues, like, what do you think the upshot is? Do you think that it was really just the huge amount of cash payments that the administration gave to farmers that really put them over the edge? Or do you think that this was just kind of always going to be the way that they voted?
There are lots of reasons to believe that, you know, the farm sector probably would have voted overwhelmingly for Trump anyway. Like 4 years ago, for instance, in Governing Magazine, Alan Greenblatt wrote about how rural voters tend to be more conservative on family and social issues, more so than city dwellers and suburbanites. They have higher rates of property ownership, and they're more likely to be self-employed, which means they're less likely to turn to the government for solutions. As a result, the partisan split between voters is more pronounced along geographic lines than any other measure. Or there's this article in Quartz written by Dan Kopf, who refers to demographer William Frey at the Brookings Institution, who says that the urban preference for Democrats comes down largely to views on religion and diversity. And then Kopf writes, rural Americans tend to be more religious, anti-abortion, and pro-gun rights, and are less likely to believe that racism is a major problem in the United States. The Republican Party platform is a better fit for them.
That is true. It's very the Republican Party platform, as it stands today, is a much better place for them.
Yeah. Well, you know, I wrote down a few things because I did some research ahead of the program. You know, as I told you earlier, 2.42 million farms in the United States, 1.97 million of them have whites as their, you know, white producers.
Mm-hmm.
That's 96% or 97% of, you know, farmers and ranchers in the United States are white. I mean, there's, as you say, 1.97 million of those farms. There's 35,000 black farms, black-owned farms, and Hispanic or Latinx, 86,000 farms. This is based on the 2017 Census of Agriculture by USDA. There's some of this is,
racial.
If you're a farmer, who you see are people who look like you.
Yeah.
And, anyway, I'll stop there. You see, it's a system dominated by white farmers, and it used to be heavily male. Although the 2017 Census of Agriculture did a more extensive job in trying to identify producers, because in looking at producers, it asks just for one person. You're filling out the form. Who's the producer?
Mm-hmm.
And in 2017, they tried looking at there are other people involved in production. So they came up with more women, and 56% of producers of this in the United States are women, according to the 2017 census. They have 43% of the land.
Yeah.
And as you can imagine, the farms operated by black or Hispanic or Asian or other persons of color, they're smaller. They produce less, have lower volumes of dollar sales than the white-owned farms. Of course, some of it's because the white-owned farms there's so much more of them.
Okay, we are going to take a break here, but we will be right back, so stay tuned. This episode is brought to you by Appeal. Here at HRN, we care about reducing waste across our food system, from farms to home kitchens. We know that about half the produce we grow ends up in the trash. We all want to enjoy produce at peak freshness and reduce the amount that gets thrown away. That's where Appeal comes in. Appeal is a plant-based protective layer that helps produce last up to twice as long. It's edible, invisible, and imitates how peels naturally protect fruits and vegetables. Because here's the thing, less waste doesn't just mean we're throwing less food away. It also means we waste less water, energy, and other resources that go into growing produce. Appeal works with nature to reduce waste across the food system, from the farm to the kitchen. Appeal helps us conserve our precious resources to ensure we have fresh food to meet our growing need. Appeal, food gone good. Learn more at appeal.com. All right. Well, I've got a couple more questions. Then I want to talk about the urban rural divide.
Okay.
So
all right.
when you look at maps of the U.S. that show the election results by land versus population density, mm-hmm. It's such a stark comparison. You see so clearly that urban areas are very heavily populated and very blue, and rural areas are sparsely populated and very conservative, which is obviously what we've been talking about. And this divide only seems to be getting bigger and bigger with more and more people continuing to move to cities. I think one of the things this election also has brought to the forefront, and this is certainly, in my opinion, something that I'm really adamant about, is the push for electoral college reform.
Mm-hmm.
But I also want to understand, because by the way, I live in New York City and my vote does not count equally as, anyone else's. So I want to understand, though, what the repercussions would be for rural America if every vote was, in fact, weighted equally, if we went by the popular vote, to say nothing of reforming the two senators per state rule.
The argument against that approach would be that, the presidential campaigns would be run, would be contested in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, Dallas, and Miami. And, if you don't live within, easy driving distance of those cities, you'll never see a presidential candidate. There's no reason for them to come and see you. In some ways, this is like Trump, you know, when he went to, you know, memorably, when he went to Erie, Pennsylvania, trying to get the Pennsylvania vote, and then the rally,
and
said,
then,
you know,
he's like, why am I here?
Winning. I wasn't going to come here.
Yes. Yes, I know.
And that's, you know, so, and that's the concern obnoxious. That people have. I mean, you know, just do the.
Does that matter? Who cares if you campaign there?
It does matter in that, you know, that people want. And they're voters, and the others, and citizens of the United States, you know, they want and they deserve to have attention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As a comparison I can make to you, because you say you live in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I grew up in Illinois, big important state, and I worked for 3 or 4 years in Iowa. And, you know, I got the writing about the issues in Iowa. Iowa's a major agricultural state. And, you know, I got, within the news organization world, I got the experience of, yeah, that's nice, what you're writing about. But, you know, the mayor of Chicago just had a news conference, and that's going to lead what we're reporting today.
Yes.
You know, so that, you know, that is the, I mean, that's the argument about why you have to have some way to, if it's going to be totally, totally popular vote, you have to find some way to assure that people who are not in the population centers, you know, are not overlooked.
Right. And then, yeah. Then the question is, what does that look like in terms of, you know, actual representation and also.
Yeah. And one other thing, I have to throw this in here because you talked about when one looks at the maps after the presidential election and states are red or blue,
mm-hmm.
and you see vast swaths of red across the central part of the country, you have to take into account that, you know, it's not either or.
Right.
It can be, you know, like in Michigan 4 years ago, a relative handful of votes can make the difference between what color that state is in the map. And it really means that there's a big diversity of viewpoint. It's not like it's not that everybody in Michigan believes this, and this is somewhat of an example. The third House district in Nebraska, which is like the western half or more of Nebraska, you could say that's the most agricultural state and most agricultural district in the country because it has the largest number of farms.
Okay.
33,294 of them in the 2017 Census of Agriculture. But there are 561,000 people in that congressional district. And, yes, only 54% of that district is considered to be rural.
Hmm.
The rest of the so you're right there, like close to half the people in that district, which, like I said, you could argue the most agricultural district in the country. You know, they live in town.
Yeah.
And you'll indulge me for the moment. The second most agricultural district, based by number of farms,
mm-hmm.
is the fourth district of Iowa, which is the northwestern quadrant of Iowa.
Okay.
Easiest way to think of it. 33,007 farms. And the district is 51, barely, you know, just a little bit over, you know, barely almost 51% rural. So even there, you have a lot of people who live in what the Census Bureau defines as rural, rural areas. Not rural areas, urban areas.
Urban areas.
So, you know, this is one of the troubles in talking about rural districts or farm states. There's a lot of diversity within the people that you're covering.
Yeah, and that's that is not to be missed. I think that is an incredibly important point. And listen, I am from Michigan, actually. Oh. And so I acutely understand, first of all, how just a few votes can make such a big difference. And also, like, you know, you're looking at, Democrats lost Michigan by 10,000 votes in 2016.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That still means that almost 50% of the voters in Michigan voted for Clinton. So,
right, yeah.
Point well taken. Absolutely. And And yet,
this divide still exists, right? Mm-hmm. If we want to think about where do we find common ground? Because it's only going to get, I fear, worse, and it needs to be addressed, 30 years ago. Let's start now, right? Where is there common ground? Are there any prominent, like, non-governmental programs aimed at doing this that are particularly successful that you've seen? And then, ooh, as another question, what is a policy fix to address this divide?
On the first part of your question, I would be hard pressed to find to name an organization that's doing that sort of work, and that probably just means I haven't been paying attention.
Well, I doubt that. You know this field. So
there have been efforts to improve urban and rural understanding. There have been grassroots level sorts of things, like the farm, farm bureaus have I need some way to describe it. This technique of a county farm bureau. Then my father was in the farm bureau in Illinois, and this county farm bureau in Illinois, so he was part of this at one time. County farm bureau ends up being matched with an urban legislator, and they dutifully, go to Chicago two or three times and talk about their issues with, the state rep that they've been, it's their representative in this initiative. And, they expect this state rep to come out and visit their part of the state and, get immersed in what we care about out here. Mm-hmm. That's an example of these ongoing grassroots levels to try to improve understanding. If you'll indulge me. And then one time when my dad was part of this, visiting the state legislator in Chicago, this state senator dropped by for a few minutes. His name was Barack Obama. He seemed to be a guy that was going somewhere.
Oh, my God. That is amazing.
So here we go. And I'm the guy living in Washington, supposedly with the entree to elected officials.
Yeah. Wow, that is... That is amazing.
So anyway, there are ongoing efforts. There's probably foundations out there that are giving out large sums of money to work on this area. And it is an issue that's deserves consideration, because here we go diving into the numbers again. Mm-hmm. Mary Kay Thatcher, who for a long time was the lead lobbyist at the American Farm Bureau Federation, and who would do this sort of work, has done the math and come out with this point of, roughly 15% of the American population lives in rural areas. If you take 435 seats in the U.S. House, 15% is 70. So that means there are, 70 districts that would count as rural. And in a recent presentation, she said 8 of those have Democrats as their representatives.
Is that true?
Yeah, I mean she's reliable on this.
I can't trust anything these days.
I understand. There were lots of reasons to during the campaign to doubt things that people were saying. But Mary Kay Thatcher is reliable. Has been in this part of the business for a while, and that is an issue that does
number.
Pose.
I think
it does pose
number.
Questions for how Congress operates and how legislation and how food and farm policy is written. Mm-hmm. As if there were because you can think about right now, the House is controlled by Democrats, yet most of the agricultural/rural districts are represented by Republicans. When you go to a meeting in the House Agriculture Committee, the Republicans are not going to have they're going to have a minority of the votes.
Yeah.
This is like, when we were talking a few minutes ago about how people living in rural areas need to have their views known. you know, they could arguably say that, you know, we're not getting a fair hearing here because not everybody in this committee is from a rural area.
Right. But, and or and you can say that it doesn't just affect rural areas, you know, that decisions made in those communities affect the entire country.
Right. Yeah. And you know, that is totally correct. And there's, you know,
I'm like, let me at him, Chuck.
but you know, as,
going to Washington.
As, you know, as Ken Cook from the Environmental Working Group, you know, opined to me one time, you know, the farm groups, when the Ag Committee meets, the farm groups are the people standing right next to the committee members, and the folks who are advocating for other stuff, you know, they don't have the ear of the committee members. Mm-hmm. People in the past, people got on the Ag Committee because they were from agricultural districts.
Right.
That was the thing they cared about most. You know, 3/4 of the budget of the USDA is spent on public nutrition programs, yet many of the people on the committee in the past, you know, cared more about, you know, what was the loan rate going to be for corn in the farm support systems.
Yeah, then the 50 million people on SNAP.
Right, yeah, right.
Okay, so last question, because I know it is a Sunday evening and I know that we're over, but I just love talking. I could continue this conversation forever. But my last question is, in looking towards the future, right, which I'm pretty excited about, Biden has been clear about addressing climate change, you know, that being one of his top four kind of like platforms. To what extent do you think this will include agriculture? And do you think this is like a natural starting point for people to help kind of like bridge that urban-rural gap, to help get farmers a little bit more excited about Biden? Because, I mean, farmers have had their, you know, their farms and livelihoods decimated because of climate change related disasters.
Oh, okay. Well, a couple of things to say about where,
you know, high in the sky,
the path forward.
Yeah.
I mean, one, because I've, you know, one is that it's remarkable, and it's a remarkable attribute of democracy, how so many people from various points of view can find a mandate in the election results. Because, you know, I have some printouts of, you know, statements made by various groups after the election, and, you know, for instance, the National Farmers Union, which tends to be lean toward Democrats, talks about how they're looking forward to climate smart practices that the Biden administration will bring in, and
That's probably part of informing my thinking.
Yeah, and you know, how Biden is committed to revitalizing rural economies and enforcing the antitrust laws, which means going, in their viewpoint, means going after the meat packers and the big seed companies. He's going to improve the Affordable Care Act, alleviate racial inequality in agriculture, expand rural broadband.
Like, that sounds great.
And the Farm Bureau. You know, looks at the election results and says, you know, whoa.
They're fake.
You know, the priorities for agriculture are expanding trade and market access, which means doing something about the trade war.
Yeah.
You know, expanding rural broadband, finding a solution to farm labor, which means resolving immigration law.
Yeah.
And then there's, strengthen the farm bill. and you know, more
what
regulatory relief would be a good thing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's basically written by administration people now,
the American Farmlands Trust says, you know, the Biden victory is, supports our view that we need more cover crops.
Yeah, well, you know, environmental protections and,
you know, and the renewable fuel people say, well, yeah, Joe Biden, he's been for ethanol for a long time, so we're going to get a fair shake for once.
Yeah. What a mess.
I said all that. But, you know, when you look at the website for the Biden campaign, the transition website, buildbackbetter.org, and you look at the climate change part of, Biden has put his priorities on four things, and one of them is climate change. And you read about climate change, he mentions agriculture.
Yay.
And during the debates and on the night that Saturday night he declared victory. I mean, he talked about carbon sequestration, or carbon capture is probably what he said, mm-hmm. which is one of the arguing points of what agriculture can do as part of climate change mitigation. One of my fellow ag journalists, Chris Clayton at DTN, has written a book about climate change and agriculture. And in the past week, he remarked about how this is the same discussion we had a decade ago, where the Obama administration was going to act on climate change and agriculture's role in it was going to be carbon sequestration. And and that initiative, just got bogged down, horribly bogged down in the House. And by the time the debate finished, as Chris Clayton said, you could not say the words climate change in a farm, at a farm group meeting, and expect it to be received politely.
Well, that's depressing.
There are a number of initiatives within the ag community towards climate change. So, some of this may be it takes time for ideas to percolate and for people to think about what they might do to see that this could benefit them either through increased productivity or higher profits.
Do you think the farming community is coming around to the idea that like climate change is a problem and needs to be addressed?
That's TBD. Difficult to say.
Yeah.
On Tuesday, a new organization is supposed to be announced in Washington. It would be called the Food and Agriculture Climate Alliance.
And it's
supposed to be composed of a number of prominent organizations representing farmers, ranchers, forest land owners, the food sector, environmental advocates, and state governments. The Environmental Defense Fund is part of the four leaders of this group. And they say, this group supposedly has more than 40 recommendations it will deliver to Congress and the administration on climate actions.
Mm-hmm.
They're sort of playing it close to the vest in what they're going to propose. Otherwise, who would come to the news conference?
Anything you'll be keeping your eye out on in particular over the next couple of weeks?
Well, the thing that's getting the most attention right now, of course, is the parlor game of who's going to be Secretary of Agriculture.
Yeah. Yes.
The minor, with a side show of who's going to be the House Agriculture Chairman.
Mm-hmm. Any bets?
On either of those?
Yeah.
It's easier to handicap the House race, which is that probably, if you go by if the past is prologue,
mm-hmm.
David Scott from the Atlanta area will become the first Black chairman of the House Agriculture Committee.
Wow.
He is second in seniority in the committee, Colin Peterson being first, and Colin mm-hmm. Peterson was defeated for re-election.
Mm-hmm.
And Democrats tend to follow seniority in choosing committee chairs. So,
well, that is exciting.
Yeah. And then for Agriculture Secretary, it's a much harder, harder picture to turn into a, recognizable image. Because, there's a number of people running. In the past, you know, in the past two or three administrations, you know, it was really advantageous to be a former member of Congress or a former governor. But, you know, you've had, you know, you had Earl Butz, Dean of Agriculture at Purdue. You had, in the Reagan administration, you had a college president. They brought in, you know, Ann Veneman. You know, she was, I was going to say California Secretary of Agriculture, and I realized I haven't checked her biography, so I shouldn't say that. But, you know, they occasionally bring in people from the state level. So it's, you know, it's hard to pick that way. And then you have to bring into mind that presidents, you know, have made a number of promises to different constituencies.
Mm-hmm.
On the Biden transition website, their first page about the transition, they say, we want an administration that looks like America.
So a commitment to diversity and
right,
equality.
Which means means diversity in the cabinet.
Yeah, right, that'd be nice. I'd be really excited about that.
Yeah. but again, about keeping things in mind, you know, presidents first off have to choose, you know, the secretaries of state, treasury, defense, and mm-hmm. justice. Those are the big, you know, those are the big four.
Yeah.
And arguably state, defense, and treasury are perhaps the top three. So mm-hmm. they have to make those choices. And then, you know, agriculture is in the next round. And by that point, you know, if different groups feel they've been slighted in the first round, they make increasing demands about how they have to be recognized in the second round. And the presidents also, you know, recognize that they've made commitments. You know, and they need to try to, as I wrote once, they need to carry out those commitments by literally giving people a seat at the table.
Yeah.
in this case, the cabinet table.
It's a pretty big table.
So people who might have, you know, seemed like the front runner, you know, their chances fade because, you know, other folks have gotten have gotten other cabinet choices.
Yeah.
And some of it gets around to timing. Some presidents name agriculture secretaries fairly quickly. Donald Trump, this is one of these oddities, interviewed Sonny Perdue, you know, early on in the process of the transition, but did not name an agriculture secretary, Sonny Perdue, until the day before his inauguration.
Yeah, wow. Ugh, so, he could have waited.
Yeah, it was one of those, as I said, it's an oddity. Apparently, they had decided, you know, had settled on who they wanted, but they
just didn't. Yeah, you know. And he lasted. He's still there,
which is
a testament in this administration with the turnover.
Right. Well, yeah. There's this famous story of how when Trump was threatening to pull out of NAFTA, that Perdue went to the White House with a map showing him which states would be affected. And so the president decided that renegotiating was better.
Oh my God. Wow.
But, you know, it's one of those, yeah, Perdue lasted. I mean, when Tom Vilsack was Secretary of Agriculture and it was nearing the end of his 8 years as secretary, he was arguing that, you know, that Trump ought to be looking for somebody who'd been a governor, which, you know, Sonny Perdue was.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Vilsack's argument for that was that, as a governor, you handle a lot of different issues.
Yeah.
You know, you have to prioritize. You have to be able to delegate. And he said that those were things that cabinet members have to do, because you know no matter how skilled you are, you can't do it by yourself.
I'm sure there's going to be lots more stories like that kind of trickling out of folks' administration. And I look forward to hearing them.
All right. Well, we are going to have to leave it there today. I want to thank you so much for coming on and all the time you gave me, Chuck. This was like really, really a fun conversation. Thank you.
I want to give a big thanks to our sponsors. Our show intern is Amber Chung. Our show engineer is Matt Patterson. And the music is by Tim Archer. All episodes of Eating Matters are available on the HRN website or as a podcast, wherever they're found. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe. I'm Jenna Liute, and thanks for listening.
Eating Matters is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right-hand side of our homepage. Thanks for listening.